Hello, everyone. I'm Tech Sergeant Shane Hughes, and you're listening to Beyond the Horizon, a podcast produced by the Ohio Air National Guard's 178th Wing in Springfield, Ohio. On today's show, I interviewed Master Sergeant Jeremy Owens and Lieutenant Colonel Brad Kennedy about our medical group's response to the COVID-19 pandemic and civil unrest that swept the nation over the summer. I hope you enjoy the show. Gentlemen, welcome to the show. Thank you for being here.
Well, thank you.
Thanks for having us.
So if you would go ahead and start off by introducing yourselves to our audience just so they can recognize your voices later on in the show, since we have two of you here today.
I'm Lieutenant Colonel Brad Kennedy. I serve as the Deputy Commander and Medical Administrative Officer for the 178th Medical Group, 178th Wing.
I'm Master Sergeant Jeremy Owens, Medical Technician with the 178th Medical Group here at the 178th Wing.
So go ahead and start off by telling me about the missions that we supported and then what kind of support we provided during those missions.
We were tasked with a number of different missions during the COVID response. Initially, as requests came in through the civil authorities to the Joint Force Headquarters and the Joint Task Force that was stood up, most of the focus was on congregate areas like prisons. We started off in Elkton up in northern Ohio, and we ended up picking up missions that included other, that was a federal mission, but we had Ohio Department of Correction missions in Pickaway, and I think that there was also another corrections location in Belmont. In addition to that, we have team members that supported the mobile testing teams doing pop-up testing sites in support of the Ohio Department of Health, as well as the isolation area up at Camp Perry, where folks, if they needed to do a self-imposed quarantine, it wasn't a forced quarantine, but they could go up there and stay for 2 weeks before they went back to their family. So we provided medical support up to there. All of those missions are in addition to the fact that we had additional personnel stood up for our unit control center and supporting the emergency operations center at the wing, as well as the CAT for the wing. In addition, we had individuals that were activated and supported both the Joint Task Force. We had a Joint Task Force surgeon up there, a member that supported in that role, and on the staff, the J staff for the Joint Task Force. So we had individuals from our med group that was in the field, higher headquarters as well as here at the wing, that together supported virtually all of the operations. And that's in addition to the role that we had providing medical support to the security force personnel that were activated to provide support to the civil unrest that some of the Ohio cities experienced.
Could you go into a little more detail about the support that our airmen were providing on those missions?
So as it pertains to the support that our personnel provided in regards to the requested assistance, we had individuals that were providing medical support, and I'll use the prisons as an example. They had an increasing number of incarcerated individuals that were reliant on the facility's medical area or department for their personal care. And so as their numbers increased, they needed additional staffing. While the prison staff was responding, their staff was getting sick. So now they had, not only did they have an increased number of sick prisoners on top of the regular everyday issues, now they had decreased amounts of staff or folks that were in quarantine because of exposure. So when we were requested to provide staff that would provide direct medical care to the individuals that were sick within the prisons, decompressing essentially the situation that they found themselves in with a large population with a significant number of sick individuals and not having the medical staff. They had the infrastructure and they had the equipment, but they didn't have the staff members. And so that's where we came in, bringing people with the medical expertise. On some of the other missions, like the testing teams, we would roll people up. The initial request came down that they were looking for people with medical faculties about them, whether it's a nurse or a 4N or whatnot, that could take part in testing teams. And they would be trained over at Ohio State University, and then they would be deployed to go from area to area. Different type of a mission, but a mission that required medical expertise. So they would frame what those requirements were when the request would come down, and then we would pick the appropriate people to fill.
Sergeant Owens, go ahead and tell me a little bit about what your personal experience was like on the ground.
So my experience on the ground at the prison mission, we started out, it was still fairly new to our group that went to support the nursing staff and provider staff, because Elkton was the first one, and they had been there for, I think, a couple of weeks or so before we were sent to Marion. arriving at Marion, didn't know what to expect. Nobody had done this kind of mission before that was there, and that's for security forces and for medical. Arriving there, we were briefed that there were 2,600 inmates, roughly, at that prison, and about 2,500 plus were testing positive. So that's a huge percentage, obviously. And we've learned a lot about how to socially distance and how to clean things properly. At this point, earlier on, when we started these missions, people, I think, were a little bit more cognizant, more apprehensive. So getting started, the initial brief was, okay, this is the number of people we have. This is the number of people that are sick. We have an ICU set up in the infirmary. We also have a sick call where they're continually treating just patients on the regular, whether they are diabetics or hypertension patients, you know, high blood pressure type issues. So that had to still be an ongoing process while taking care of the sick people. And as patients or as these inmates started to become patients in the infirmary because they've contracted coronavirus and developed COVID and have other comorbidities like heart issues, respiratory issues, diabetes, again, obesity, those things all contribute to them being ill. We saw, I would say it's probably about a quarter, about 25% of the people that were inmates there in my time there were sick enough to be in the infirmary set up as an ICU. The resources there, yeah, they had supplies, equipment, but it was not set up to be an ICU like a hospital. So as the patients became worse, obviously we were trying to maintain them, but if they became worse, mostly respiratory issues, then we would have to send them to OSU's ICU, where they would be cared for and hopefully return back to the prison after they got well. So again, part of that briefing was making sure that we all had a number of sets of scrubs that were purchased for us, the tennis shoes or whatever shoes you were going to wear there for doing patient care went to the prison and they never came out of the prison. At the end of my time there and everybody else, we threw all of our extra shoes into the trash can, just making sure that we're being responsible and not tracking anything out of the floor or off the floors into the stores and hotel and places that we were allowed to go during that time. Just trying to be, you know, responsible about it. PPE was something that we had a good amount of. We had plenty of. Any time that we were in contact with patients, we always had gowns, the face shields, goggles or face shield, of course, mask, and it was always N95 masks. At this point, you know, people are using regular surgical medical masks, fabric masks. But then we didn't know as much as we know about it now. Didn't know how quickly it transmitted. So N95s is what we used.
The situation with setting up an ICU sounds like that had to have been pretty challenging.
It was, because when you think of the population of a prison, it's pretty condensed. There's a lot of people in a small space. The segregation block, called O block, is typically set up for behavioral issues of inmates. Where they would be locked down away from general population, whether it's a dorm or another cell block. No outside privileges, things like that. That's, again, typically for behavioral issues. There were some in the segregation unit, but it was also an overflow for sicker patients. People that required treatment but were not sick enough to be in the infirmary ICU. The makeshift ICU, it's not set up to be an ICU, so all of the even the infrastructure of electricity, you know, that you would see in an ICU hospital room, oxygen lines coming out of the wall, enough outlets to run equipment. They didn't have it, so they were running extension cords. Didn't have enough heat because these people were, in some cases, feverish and needed needed the temperature control. That's not something that's common in just a regular infirmary. They're there for a short time because they're sick, for a couple of days maybe. They might be transported out to further treatment, but in this case, it was just not set up for an ICU, and so they did what they could. So yeah, there were some stressors and some issues. There are some factors that played into making it functional. When they became sick enough, they were transported out to an ICU locally, OSU. When it became a case where the providers just couldn't care for them any further, they just didn't have the supplies or equipment on hand to do that.
And talk to me a little bit about the experience during the civil unrest. What was that like?
During the civil unrest period over in Columbus, going into it, again, this was something that, as a medic, nothing I had experienced before. I had done some combat casualty care training with security forces here on the base. So these guys knew me. They knew that I had some experience and that I could help them out. So they requested that we send a medic to support our security forces personnel. I set up our six-pack Blue Steely as a roaming ambulance, the EMS-type equipment that we would need, and rolled out with security forces. Our first night in, we met up at Rickenbacker Air National Guard Base, and we were escorted over by security forces and MPs from the Army side into town on order of the city police chief, or request of the city police chief. We started out with the security forces and police officers guarding critical infrastructure, power plants, things like that. And my job was to be on standby and move location to location, having a two-way radio and having comm with cell phones to make sure that if anything happened where there was contact with protesters and someone was hurt, that I responded to assist and treat that injured person.
You kind of talked about it a little bit already, but why are these missions that we supported important?
So the Guard is specially equipped to be able to respond to the needs of agencies on the civilian side. If a county finds itself in any type of a situation where they've exhausted all of the options that they have available to them locally, they push the request up to the state. And the state has, but through mutual aid agreements or through the EMAC process or what have you, they don't have any way to fill the gap. Once that gap's been identified, the governor and the TAG can look at the Guard resources that are available. So the rules apply a little bit differently than it would for an active component service. That's why the Guard exists. We can be called up and activated under the governor's order. And so we're able to respond quickly with trained credentialed personnel. Legal framework exists to allow us to be able to practice medicine in the field if we were activated through appropriate channels by appropriate authorities. So we're able to go in on request to a validated mission to assist everything from moving equipment to decompressing a hospital to setting up alternate care sites, which there was a lot of planning that went into that. Or as you've seen in these missions with the prisons, long-term care facilities, assisting with the mobile testing teams, and even providing support to the lab, the state lab that was conducting these tests. The National Guard Bureau's Joint Surgeon's Office, through the regional medical plans officer positions that they have in each of the FEMA regions, actually does a great job. FEMA Region 5, which is where our state resides, Jack McAfrican is the RMPO, Major McAfrican. And so those folks actually do a lot of groundwork prior to there being any request to set up relationships, to get folks to understand on the civilian side what capabilities that we bring to the table so that they understand that we do have the ability to be able to plug gaps that might arise. During the course of exercises and plans reviews, we sometimes get ahead of that and can build mission response packages so that the civil authorities understand what it is that we have in our arsenal, so to speak, whether it's equipment, supplies, consumable supplies, or personnel, what we have that we can bring to bear if there was a need, and control their expectations for not only the timeline it would take for us to respond, but how long we could be on ground supporting, as well as future ops continue to develop, controlling their expectations once we draw down and they have to take over those operations. So between the National Guard Bureau's Joint Surgeon's Office and these RMPOs, all the way down to our individual unit, with those relationships being built as situations are assessed, whether it's a hurricane, tornado, or in this case, a pandemic, there's already been a little bit of groundwork laid. And then as triggers are met, validated requests are seen, then it gives us the opportunity to exercise these lines of communication that have already been put into existence, and we're able to get folks on the ground.
So how has our training helped prepare you for these missions?
Medical group personnel, specifically nursing services and people like myself who are medical technicians, we're required to follow National Registry EMT guidelines and be certified under NREMT. So having gone through that training for a number of years, the TCCC training, the combat casualty care training that we've done with security forces here at Springfield Base and at the CRTC bases that here at Springfield and at our CRTC locations outside of the state of Ohio, we've done training, mock village run-throughs with security forces, clearing buildings and attending to any injuries, along with having TCCC trainees or trainers come in who are military medics, whether they're Navy, Army, or Air, come in here to the unit and provide us combat casualty care training, similar to self-aid and buddy care, a little bit more integrated, a little bit more tactical. All of that training that we've gone through, it really comes in handy when you're thinking, again, tactically. If you're considering whether you're in the city streets of Columbus or in an AOR downrange with a unit that you're responsible for taking care of medically if something does happen, you're able to put to use the steps that you've gone through and trained by triage, making sure that you're treating appropriately according to the scene. The training we have gone through, we would use, you would consider triage, you would consider the tactics involved in taking care of somebody when under attack by a combatant. And that does, it doesn't matter whether you are in theater or whether you're city streets of Columbus again. That's the mindset that we've developed as medics. We were able to think ahead, look at your scene, and look at how to keep yourself and your crew safe and how to treat them appropriately depending on what the situation is.
And anything specifically that helped prepare you for the prison mission?
Specifically for the prison mission, just the repetitive ongoing training. In my own experience, just as having worked in EMS for a long time, even aside from military medical, it was mostly clinical setting. There were two patients that unfortunately had passed while I was there that I did work as full arrest. The first day in, 5 minutes into my first shift, a gentleman dropped within the infirmary and somebody's calling for help.
That's quite the introduction.
Correct. Right. Definitely. So we had to treat that patient as any other patient. It was full arrest situation. And just having my own experience and going through the ongoing training that we do for EMS and for military medical, I know what to do. I know how to use the equipment that we would use. I know the process, what to expect. And then later on, probably a month into that time at the Marion prison, there was another gentleman that I had to, I was the one where we were called down the hall for a man with respiratory distress and got him moved to our clinic, our walk-in clinic. And I recognized that he was declining pretty quickly, treated him appropriately, and made contact with the attending provider physician there. and let him know that we had to do the steps that we needed to do to try to resuscitate this gentleman because he was declining rapidly. Gave direction to the security forces and the COs there on site to help me get him to the floor, started to resuscitate him. Eventually, sent him with EMS to the hospital locally, and he did pass, but it was the clinical impression was that he had a pulmonary embolism, which typically patients are not going to recover from. It's useful to have that information, to have the training. It doesn't always work out, of course. Hopefully you save somebody down the line, but it definitely has prepared us, any of us that have gone on the prison missions, to do what we need to do.
So in regards to the training, one of the things that I think has brought to light in this particular situation with the pandemic response is over the course of all of our careers, we all take part in a number of different exercises, disasters of one type or another. Sometimes medical doesn't necessarily get the due attention that it deserves. But I think this forced the spotlight onto the medical situation, and rightly so. It was a situation that required everybody pulling together, and it's something that's still being wrestled with today. And we're concerned about what the autumn's going to bring in addition to the flu. But all of our service members, blue and green alike, Army and Air, and all the other services, we're all trained to operate in austere environments and being able to show a high degree of flexibility, being able to deal with unknown components that pop up at a moment's notice. And I think all of the folks that we had on the ground on the tactical level did a phenomenal job being able to take their operational environment as it was given to them and being able to set up their footprint and provide care and in some cases life-saving care to individuals that needed it when we were called and when we were asked. And so I think it gives credence to the training that everybody applies themselves to. And I'm hoping that as the future, some of the lessons learned that we pull from this gets played into future exercises. Some of the areas where we didn't particularly focus on before, it gets that due focus.
So how did these missions help benefit our airmen?
So as it comes to the missions and benefiting the airmen, they benefit from a couple of different standpoints. One, the experience that they're getting. So there's only so much you can get out of training. When you get to actually put into practice what's talked about, what's written down in a plan, those opportunities sometimes are few and far between for a guard soldier or guard airman. There's no point in taking dancing lessons if you don't get to go to the ball, right? So we've set these airmen up with the training that they need, and we've equipped them. And this was not a situation where individuals were forced against their will to activate. Everybody that was on mission was actually a volunteer, and so they were jumping at the opportunity to get out and assist. So one, they're getting a practical application of the skill sets that they've been provided through training and planning. But it goes deeper than that, because this isn't a war. It's a war on the pandemic, yes, but we're not overseas fighting a contingency operation. We're helping the homeland, and we're taking care of our neighbors. And so I think from the guard member standpoint, to be able to stand up and do something that's going to help their own community and their own state, that is one of the things that adds the most meaning to service for a guards member. And it's not something that our active component brothers and sisters necessarily get to partake in like we do. That's one of the reasons the guard exists. It's one of the reasons why a lot of people are in the guard. And so for us to be able to take our skill set and apply it in a way that's going to benefit our citizens and the populations in our communities, that's meaningful to them. And it's something that they're going to take away from this. So from those two standpoints, these airmen get a lot out of these missions.
So can you tell me a little bit about some of the different interactions you had with other people while you were on these missions, the patients, the nurses, the doctors?
Yeah, so starting with the prison and the nurses that I worked with there, there were some contract nurses that were there, and then there were some full-time staff. And they definitely showed that they were overwhelmed. They had been running their butts off before we showed up. And they also were so glad that we were sent there to help. Even if it was just helping facilitate a sick call for the morning hours, because there were so many that could not get to, again, that commissary to get their regular over-the-counter stuff. They were coming to sick call without appointments. They had scrubbed the appointments for a time, and then they started requiring it a little bit later to control things. They were just overwhelmed. And also the same with the COs, the correctional officers on the civilian side for the prison. They were so glad to have those MPs and security forces members, officers there, because they had several that were out sick. So they were quarantined for, 14 days at a time, many of them. And they're... Being that you had had to create more restrictions, it caused a little bit of unrest, or actually in some cases a lot of unrest within the inmates, their housing areas. And so the inmates were upset with the nursing staff, with the provider staff, the physicians, and with the COs, because it wasn't the norm. They were more restricted. They couldn't move about like they wanted to, like they normally would. They couldn't get the things that they needed, again, medically, or that they wanted. And this is over the counter. This is not life-threatening things. Certainly, they would take care of the life threats. On the average, the norm, stuff that you would pick up, they couldn't get themselves. And sometimes the supply would run out until that next delivery was made that day. But again, not life threats. And the providers, there were only three of them there that are staffed at that within that clinic. And more people had runny noses. And they wanted to see the doctors. And they just couldn't get in as fast as they wanted. So the provider staff, the physicians, the nursing staff, and the COs were really glad to have us there.
From the more operational or strategic side, there was a lot of interaction. I had mentioned the Greater Dayton Area Hospital Association, the regional health collaboratives. Ohio was broke up in a couple of different ways, but we had a lot to do with Region 6 and Region 3, which included all of Southwest Ohio. Then the Ohio Department of Public Health was heavily engaged. We worked with Tamara McBride and her group out of Columbus. Colonel Mormon actually was activated for a period of time and worked out of Joint Force Headquarters, working within those specific Ohio Department of Health zones, trying to ensure that they had some fidelity on those areas of concern that the governor wanted to keep his finger on, all the way down to the ground level where you're talking just multiple fire departments, Dayton MMRS, Dave Gershner and his group, the Greater Miami Valley EMS Council, 27 area hospitals that belonged to Gadaha. There was a great number of calls initially as people tried to sort through the multitude of issues that were being faced between staffing and logistics and planning, because they wanted to present solidarity in the message that was being presented to the public, whether it had to do with visitors, specific processes and procedures, wanting to keep everybody on the same page. When we were talking about alternate care sites and we started dealing with private sector folks and looking at all those different ways that we could bring folks in to help on a lot of these calls and a lot of these interactions, folks from all walks of life, all specialties and areas of expertise. So it really does take a multitude to deal with something large scale like this. Whether it's a pandemic or a hurricane, there's a number of players that come into play. And it's not just the local and state level. You're talking federal players too, because you're dealing with HHS, Health and Human Services, and you're dealing with FEMA. So all of these individuals have input, they have resources. Of course, there's the CDC. So there was a lot of people working to work in lockstep to deal with this head on.
So what were some of the similarities and differences between the different mission sets that we had?
So my own personal experience, the similarities, obviously, again, we've got different branches working together. Again, we can understand each other because of the type of joint training we've done. The medical treatment being provided is obviously vastly different because you have a controlled, and believe it or not, in a prison, a controlled environment where these people are just sick. They want help. They are introducing themselves and asking us if we were National Guard and thanking us for being there. They actually appreciated your support being there. We're treating those people because they're ill from a disease. And when you go to Columbus, Ohio, the civil unrest situation where you have injuries, it's not a bunch of beds with guys in it who are sneezing and coughing. It's people who are, depending on what they're doing, they could be injured. There could be bloodshed and broken bones. So it's a different skill set that you're using when you go into treat that environment.
And so I've kind of already got a little bit of a sense of this, but would you tell me a little bit, what was the ops tempo like for you?
Ops tempo within the prison system was pretty high speed. There was always something that needed to be done day to day. There were a small number of us medics. I believe that we had maybe 30 or so medics total, if I remember right. We're split into different shifts, and we would go out in crews. A crew would go out and see all of the insulin-dependent diabetics, and that was half a day of work, going cell block to cell block or dorm to dorm to assess these people, assess their blood sugar, provide them their insulin injection, and move on to the next. And there were a lot of people. Daily temperature checks. That was something that we would send a couple of crews out, and it would take all day long to make it through the majority of the prison. And you typically didn't make it through all of the dorms and cell blocks in a day. Night shift would sometimes take over and finish some, but then you got to let the people sleep, right? So it would start the next day. There was pretty high ops tempo because we're keeping up with making rounds because they were restricted to their dormitories. And then on top of it, you have regular sick call. They were not able to go to commissary to get their over-the-counter meds. They weren't allowed to, in groups, at will, go walking through the halls to come to sick call. They had to come by appointment. And then with, again, the infirmary, it was almost always full. Probably about 15 patients roughly within that infirmary, and just always something going on. So it was pretty busy. Speaking to the civil unrest in Columbus, ops tempo there. Our first night, for one, it was a 3-hour lead time when we got notification to say, hey, you need to be in Columbus. So that was interesting. We're not unfamiliar with that, but 3-hour notice, pack your stuff and head to Columbus. So we met at the armory at Rickenbacker, and within probably 2 hours of meeting there, we had an order to head to town. And so that's when we got the escort from Army MP and security forces and Humvees, and we headed to town, starting to set up checkpoints, control points, and those infrastructure guard points. The first night, after having been up doing your own thing throughout the day and then meeting here at Springfield and then processing and heading to Columbus, got back to the armory to try to get some sleep at about 2:30 in the morning. The next morning, and then had to be up at 5:30 to head out back to the city about 6 a.m. And it went like that for the first few days, little sleep and maybe a shower. And then it kind of settled down where we got an idea of exactly where they wanted to have us, broke into shifts and use the resources a little more wisely, spreading them out. And every evening, we would meet with the city police chief and a good percentage of the law enforcement from city and surrounding counties, ODOT, and get a briefing from the police chief, and then head out and start setting up security checkpoints throughout the entire city, two perimeters inside and outside. The point was to keep traffic out while the protesters were able to make their way safely through the streets and demonstrate at will. And my job, again, as the sole medic for the airside for our guard security forces support, was to remain roaming. So I was constantly moving throughout the city. I got to know the layout pretty well. And so that's how it went for me.
How did you feel about your role in these missions?
At first, I wasn't sure what my role would be exactly. And what I mean by that is, again, like I said earlier, this is something that was new that we're kind of thrust into. Yeah, we volunteered. But when you show up at Ground Zero for a hotspot at a prison and you've never worked in the prison system, medical or in the prison system at all, it's new. You don't know exactly what to expect. You see a lot of TV and theatrics. But I felt that performing my duties within this mission at the prison, that while we had people in the general public, again, that were protesting our presence, we were secure. It was a controlled environment. And I said multiple times that I actually felt for the staff that we had that were out on the food supply missions, because that's not as controlled. You're on the street. You're passing out things to the general public, and you don't know what to expect there. The only people armed in the prison are the people that are on my side, and that's a good feeling. And they were always there to back you up if something did go bad. So I felt secure. Once we got within, we got a couple of weeks into it, or maybe just several days into it. it became your norm for that month and a half, working for 10 hours, whatever it might have been, whatever your shift was, and then going back to the hotel after having changed in the locker room at the prison, leaving your scrubs there to be washed and not knowing whether you're going to get your stuff back or not, and hoping that everything stayed secure. And then you go back to your hotel room where you were supposed to stay there as much as possible, other than like grocery runs, which wasn't the greatest. But it was a decent setup. The hotel was decent. And, you know, you would go back and scrub down and wipe down all the surfaces with sanitation wipes and move on through your evening, prep for the next day. In Columbus, my personal experience, again, there were a couple of times where I was concerned. I know that you and I were up one intersection one night and you were interviewing with some people and the crowd started growing and growing. And I was approached by an undercover officer. He says, hey, I'm with so-and-so. And I said, how you doing? He displayed his credentials. And so I believed him. And he says, hey, how long are you guys going to be over here in this part of town? Because we didn't have security forces real close by. They were there, but not real close by. And I told him, you know, for a few more minutes. And he said, okay, well, said you might want to ask your friend to come on back and stand off a little bit. So then I asked him if he could walk up and get your attention. And so that was interesting. And then there was one night that we were going through town just to set up the perimeter check locations through the inner perimeter. And I don't remember if you were with us that night, but we came to an intersection and city police was there trying to get us through the intersection to further set up perimeter checks or perimeter locations. And you could see from your right a huge mob of probably about 1,000 people working their way toward you. And the procession was pretty slow with our vehicles, the Humvees and Blue Steelies and so on. So I'm right at the intersection, and there's a Humvee right in front of me, and I'm on his bumper because I didn't want to get stuck, and so we made a train out of it. And I'm hoping the guy behind me is on my bumper, and we're within inches of each other, and I'm pushing through the intersection with him. And so they had no choice but to go around me, and they kind of mobbed around me, and then they just completely enveloped that Humvee behind me. And it was about 5 seconds later that two Humvees up in the front of the pack peeled off, and they came flying back to the intersection to assist if needed. And it was pretty quick that the crowd moved on out of the way when they saw more vehicles coming to help. And then they were able to proceed and no problems. So there were a couple of situations, but nothing major.
From my standpoint, it was a unique opportunity to bring my skill set to bear. I've been a med planner for a number of years and have even worked as a regional medical plans officer for FEMA Region 5 in a prior life. So being able to bring the skill set that I have to bear for not just the wing, but when the Regional Unified Command was stood up, assisting Colonel Moore and being a part of that group, being able to go into the civilian hospitals and work those assessments and assisting with some of the ties that I already had within the state, and whether it's information exchanges or it's developing the plans and working the plan integration piece to get the guard and civilian plans, civilian components into the guard response. In addition, working the regional engagement efforts. Things got so big there for a while with multitude of calls, the team was able to break things down, and even the augmentees that we brought into the med group on orders to help augment just because of the operational tempo and because of how big things were getting. We were able to divide out calls, share notes, cover down, and make sure all the necessary needs were met. So for me, it was, I think everybody that was there, especially between late February up until the beginning of June, they found themselves constantly engaged with some long days, some things popping up even in the evening time, the weekend calls. So the operational tempo was there, but I don't think it's anything that anyone shirked at because this was real life and lives were being impacted. People that we knew were being impacted. Partnerships that we had built, those partners were being affected. So I was happy to be able to bring my domestic operational experience to the foreground in such a situation while managing to maintain and take care of my operational requirements and responsibilities within the wing for the med group. So I felt like to keep successfully, my hands in both pots, and assist Southwest Ohio while making sure that our folks that were being brought on mission were being taken care of. So I found it to be very fulfilling and rewarding. And I think anybody in the med group that you talk to would say just about the same thing.
Yeah, I agree with Colonel Kennedy with everything that he was saying, especially toward the end there. Everybody involved, if there was a word to describe the experience, would be pride. Everybody has had a sense of pride in going into these missions and learning your place within each, and being able to provide something beyond IMR services that we do for our own people here at the wing. Going out and doing the humanitarian missions that we do are very controlled. That we do on a typically annual basis for different counties. Those are fun. And again, like I said, very controlled. This was definitely an unknown, but all in all, you still come out the other end of it with a huge sense of pride.
What should people know about these missions that we haven't already discussed?
There's a lot going on behind the scenes. I think that's something that folks don't necessarily appreciate from time to time. So you have a very small core group of folks that are in the prison or in the long-term care facility or that are on the testing team. But there's the full-time staff that's completely flipped their schedules upside down and affected their families because they're manning a CAT position or a UCC or an EOC position. There's individuals because in the most emergent portion of this response, we had full-time staff that was on mission, and so everybody else was conquering and dividing those individuals' responsibilities. So they were taking more on their plates. So there was a lot of personal sacrifice made by the individuals that were here on a full-time basis. There was individuals that came in and on duty orders to actually do staff operations at the base. And then, as I mentioned previously about the Regional Unified Command and the Guard Emergency Liaison positions, these folks that were going into these hospitals and doing site assessments, that was doing in-depth planning for the alternate care sites to be stood up in conjunction with the Greater Dayton Area Hospital Association, and the immense amount of players that were involved in this. I don't believe that the public necessarily understands, the public at large understands what goes into not only the planning, but the logistical movement for a large-scale response. And this isn't an isolated occurrence within one area of our state, our geographic state. This is not just the entire state. This is the entire nation and the world. There's so much that goes into this operation. There's so much more manpower, so many more man days taking care of these specific missions than what you see in the personnel package that's being fielded for the response. So that is one thing that I don't think a lot of folks know. The second thing is just the high degree of not only flexibility, but ingenuity, that this was a great unknown. And when we started dealing with things and having some of the PPE shortages and, you know, we did the site assessments and the hospitals were trying to expand their bed capacities and Gedaha outlaid its surge plan. There was a lot of ingenious ideas that came out. There was a lot of cooperative work being done across the board with agencies, not just public sector, but private sector as well, in addition to the governmental resources, to try to provide the best for the folks being affected by this. And that impressed me, and it's something that I made clear to the president and CEO of Miami Valley Hospital, is that, you know, I'm happy that my family lives in Southwest Ohio. Being able to see firsthand the amount of planning that's taken place and the amount of effort going in to ensure people are given the best care possible, and to see the amount of folks jumping in wanting to help, and this guard team that I happen to be a part of. I'm happy here knowing that no matter what I'm doing or wherever I'm at, that my family is going to be taken care of. And I want everybody else to feel the same way.
So something I'd like to add is we notice a great deal of, again, like I said earlier, appreciation from inmates at the prison while working there, treating them as our patients. Had meaningful conversation with some of the gentlemen, and they were, again, appreciated us being there, said thank you when they knew that we were National Guard. Something that the general public around the areas because of, you know, some of the families being upset that they couldn't see their families and so on. And just general public just didn't, I don't think they understood that we were not there to come in guns a-blazing and tear everybody down and keep their visitors out. It was a safety thing. It was to keep from spreading what was a huge infection rate within that prison that I was at. I mean, it was the nation's hotspot for a number of weeks. That says something. And so our job was to make sure that, one, we're taking care of their loved ones, whether they're an inmate or not. It didn't matter what they did. I didn't know what they did, and I didn't ask. But there were individuals that set up protests across from the correctional facility where we were working. And mostly it was a weekly thing, sometimes throughout the week, but mostly weekend, putting up signs in protest of the National Guard being there, of not being able to see their families. And just wanted to make sure that people understand that it wasn't our job, for one, nor was it our want, for two, to go in and seem like we were taking the place over, because we weren't. We had a lot of security forces there and a handful of medics, and our job was only to backfill, like Colonel Kennedy said earlier on, for the people who were staff there who might have been sick or just overwhelmed because they just didn't have enough staff. The other piece of what I wanted to say is along the same line, when we were working in the city of Columbus because of the unrest there. You know, I drove by an intersection one night with the window down to my GOV truck, and a young lady rode by on her bicycle and looked me in the eye, and she says, "Oh, disgusting." And I thought, well, I said, I understand, but I don't think you understand. And I obviously didn't say anything to her. I just let her go on because it's not my job. My job was there to be there to treat somebody medically if there was a need. And again, a lot of the general public didn't realize why we were really there, was to block out vehicle traffic from bringing in anybody that would want to do harm to the civil protesters, to let them be able to roam freely through the street and do their thing. That was our job. And not once did I see a city police officer or local law enforcement officer or an officer from the military police do anything that would cause any further unrest or cause any point of contention. Everybody did their job, protected the civilians on the streets, and it went fairly well. But I don't think that people understood.
All right. Well, that's all I have for you, gentlemen. Thank you both so much for being here. I really appreciate your time today.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
That concludes today's episode of Beyond the Horizon. Thank you so much for listening. If you enjoyed today's show, make sure you subscribe and leave us a rating and review. Also, tell 5 of your best friends to listen to our show. If you're looking for more ways to connect with the 178th Wing, you can check us out on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. You can also write to us at beyondthehorizonpodcast@gmail.com with any questions you have or even stories of your own that you would like to share. Until next time, keep your eyes on the horizon.